Welcome back to Fit Body Happy Joints. My name is Shannon. Today we've got Peyton on the podcast and we are going to talk about PCOS and exercise. And if you listen to episode number 151 with Peyton, towards the end of that episode, she kind of shared her story and we didn't complete the story. She has personal experience with this that I'm going to let her talk about in just a moment. And then she also really dug into the research behind PCOS and exercise, because it just feels like this big black box. And hopefully this episode will help people, number one, not diagnose someone, of course, ever. That's beyond our scope, but maybe get some awareness around this and then help people who do have PCOS, give them recommendations for exercising to help manage their symptoms. So Peyton, do you want to start by telling us kind of your journey behind this? What brought you here?
Yes. So after where we left off in 151, I reached out to a fertility specialist that I had reached out to previously or gotten connected with previously and got set up because it just felt like it was time to get a little bit more insight into what might be going on. I honestly probably should have done it sooner, but so often the recommendation is for a quote unquote healthy, normal, young person to wait a year before, a year of trying before reaching out to a fertility specialist. And so that was kind of where my head was a bit. And so I waited and waited, but once the experience happened, it just felt like good timing to just get some more insight because I was still having the symptoms of spotting during my luteal phase. So I went to a fertility specialist here in Austin and I got a lot of testing done. I'm sure most fertility clinics are like this, but they do extensive testing between blood work, different types of ultrasounds, different tests to check on the quality of the lining of your uterus, the ability of the fallopian tubes to move things in and out, things like that. And so after getting that comprehensive evaluation, starting in October and then not really getting results until the week of the platform launch. That's how we like think of everything in our brains now.
Yes,
with timing.
Yes.
And based on all of the results that they found for me, I was diagnosed both with PCOS and with endometriosis. So I don't think that it's super common for people to have both. They're individual things and different things. But from what my doctor told me, it is common for people with Hashimoto's that I've talked about a few different times now on the podcast to have endometriosis. So I think she said 30% of people with Hashimoto's also have endometriosis.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it turns out it also has a huge familial component. And I found out after getting diagnosed that my grandmother and all of her sisters had endometriosis, and only my grandmother was able to conceive, to have a child. All of her sisters adopted. So it kind of spun me into being really interested in it, obviously on a personal level because it was happening to me, but also on a level because I felt like I didn't understand fully the exercise recommendations for one versus the other and different lifestyle recommendations. And I knew that lifestyle, or was told that lifestyle, played a big part in PCOS specifically. And so I just wanted to get more into it and thought it would be really helpful for the Fit Body Happy Joints audience as well.
Yeah. Well, because like most diagnoses, doctors don't necessarily have time to sit down with you and explain this type of exercise would be good for this diagnosis.
Right.
They kind of give you general guidelines, which is totally understandable. Number one, they're not trained in exercise specifically. And number two, they just don't have time. There's a lot of other things to go over, but exercise can be such a crucial piece of the puzzle. Yes, exactly. So I think that you talking about this can help give people more solutions. So let's back up and talk about what is PCOS. Do you want to give like a definition of PCOS?
Yeah. So PCOS is a metabolic dysfunction that affects the ovaries, and a very broad definition. And I think it's helpful to understand what PCO is and how it affects your body by thinking about how things are supposed to function normally with the reproductive system. So typically, like we mentioned in that episode 151, our cycles really start in the brain. So the brain, the hypothalamus specifically, sends a signal to the pituitary gland, which then sends out follicular stimulating hormone or follicle stimulating hormone, FSH, which then stimulates one of the follicles that are outside of the ovaries, or that the ovaries have released for that month. It stimulates one of them to grow into an egg. So that is what typically happens. And then that one egg ovulates and becomes available to potentially make a child. The outer lining of that follicle becomes what's called the corpus luteum, which makes progesterone. And if you don't end up having an insemination of that egg, then you have a period, the lining goes away, and you start the process over. So that's what typically is supposed to happen. With PCOS, you have a larger number of those follicles that are released outside of the vault each month. There's, from my understanding, there's not really a lot of understanding around why that happens in the first place. There's hypotheses that it happens because of something that you are exposed to in utero, because that's when you're all of the eggs you'll ever have are developed, is when you are a baby in your mom's womb. And so there's hypotheses that it's something that happened then, but it's not that your total number is more necessarily, but more each month, more follicles are being released and available to be stimulated. So what happens is that same level of follicle stimulating hormone is released, but you have more follicles there, so the effect of that hormone is diluted. So it doesn't have the power to stimulate one of those follicles in the same way. When that happens, the ovaries don't produce estrogen in the same way, because they only produce estrogen in the presence of a developing egg. So if that follicle stimulating hormone isn't stimulating the follicle to grow into an egg, the ovaries stop producing estrogen in the same way. That pathway is downregulated, and then instead you start producing more testosterone. So that's kind of the physiology behind what happens with PCOS.
Got it. And this seems to be, I don't know if there's increased awareness of it now, but I feel like I'm hearing about it everywhere. And I feel like I'm hearing about so many friends getting diagnosed with it. Do you feel like this is becoming more common, or do you feel like this, there's just more awareness around it?
I'm not sure from a scientific perspective the answer to that. Yeah. My inclination is to say I think there's just more understanding, more awareness, a better ability to diagnose. Yeah. And I think just women's health in general is progressing more and more. There's becoming more solutions around these women's specific diagnoses that weren't as talked about. Like, for example, again, I didn't even know my grandmother had endometriosis until after I was diagnosed, because especially in her time, that wasn't talked about.
Right.
So I think it could be just there's more awareness, but who knows? Depending on the etiology of why it happens in the first place, if we don't have a good understanding of that, then it could be that whatever factor is involved with that, maybe in utero, maybe it's an environmental toxin, who knows?
Yeah.
It could be, but also becoming more common because of that.
Yeah. Super interesting. Mm-hmm. So what are the symptoms of PCOS? I know that they can be different for everyone, mm-hmm. but if someone's like wondering, like, do I have this? What are some of the trademark symptoms?
Yes. So some of the trademark symptoms that occur, and a lot of it is because of that upregulation in testosterone, is acne, hair growth, think of like mustache or darker hair elsewhere in the body. Also hair loss or thinning, especially in the temporal region, which is interestingly enough, I think one of the symptoms that I have.
Oh, really? I've never noticed that.
Yeah. So if you can have some thinning there, it's like male pattern, yeah. like recession of your hairline there. You also typically weight retention or weight gain happens more in male patterns. So if you think about males typically hold their weight more in their bellies, if you think about like a beer belly for dads out there, as opposed to in the hips, like we typically do as females. And then with that increase in testosterone that also makes us more predisposed to metabolic conditions like insulin resistance, high cholesterol, and high blood pressure. Obesity is another one that's closely linked with PCOS and fatigue as well.
Yeah.
And oh, sorry, another one that's actually very important, so I can't miss out on it, is a lower tolerance to stress, to all types of stress. So physical, environmental, and mental.
Really? So what would be an example of having a low tolerance to stress?
So how it's been described to me, both in research and then by my own personal doctor, is because of how different our systems are functioning, that whole system that I described earlier, it's almost like you're on a hairpin trigger, my doctor describes it as, and that if you have a stressor come up, that system can go into even more haywire and can like further push you into that testosterone producing factory essentially, and make all those other symptoms worse as well. So whether that's stress at your job, whether that's over exercise, which we'll get a little bit into, whether that is a stress from potentially an environmental toxin. It's shown that people with PCOS are more sensitive to different things like different artificial fragrances, flavors, wow, different things like that. So wow, it's very interesting.
So overall, you're just more sensitive,
yes,
physically and mentally.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting. So what were your symptoms? Because I mean, I know we've talked about them, but I think it'd be interesting for you to talk about what yours were.
Yeah. The other one I forgot is cycle irregularity, which is my number one symptom. So it's one of the number one causes of cycle irregularity, especially in that luteal phase, because of everything that I mentioned that's going on, and that's not functioning correctly in that system between the brain, the pituitary gland, and then the ovaries. So cycle irregularity is my biggest, in that I'm spotting during the luteal phase and then having a full period after that. But also, interestingly, the hair, potential hair loss there. And I think those are my main symptoms, which I do believe contributed to me not being diagnosed for many years.
Yeah.
I think it's hard because I don't present in the common way. I even remember telling my mom, who's a nurse, about the diagnosis, and she immediately said, but you're not X, Y, and Z, and kind of listing off those other typical things. Like, I don't have an acne problem. I haven't struggled with obesity. And so those are ones that people typically just like put you in a category automatically. And so that was really interesting for me to be like, okay, I don't present typically, but I'm still having these major implications. And it's funny because outward symptoms are one thing and certainly are something to keep in mind, especially if you're someone who's just kind of questioning, do I maybe have this going on? But there are like very real and easy things to test for that can help to pinpoint this. And that's what happened with me when I finally got the appropriate blood work. It was very obvious.
Yeah. And do you think that your lifestyle choices have reduced your symptom intensity?
That's what my doctor specifically hypothesizes for my individual case. And she said she sees it a lot with PCOS in general, and that people don't even know they have PCOS. They make these changes, these lifestyle changes, because they're wanting to feel better.
Yeah.
And they don't know why they're feeling badly, but they want to feel better. So they kind of naturally fall into these lifestyle changes and then see such great improvements in their symptoms or improvements in their cycle and their ability to ovulate. And so, and they don't even realize the why behind it. So I think it could have I think it's very, very likely that my lifestyle has been really helpful in preventing any of these bigger symptoms from showing up in
me.
Yes.
Yes. Because obviously you do EVLO, you're not over exercising, mm-hmm, and you've also changed your diet pretty, mm-hmm, significantly after your Hashimoto's diagnosis.
Yes.
You want to talk about that a little bit? Because I think that you had a body composition change mm-hmm. with your change in diet.
Yes.
So do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. And it's very relevant to this conversation because diet is a big component of treating PCOS. Again, we're not here to diagnose you or to tell you how to treat it, but just kind of giving some insight into what is recommended in research and in general by doctors as well. With PCOS, the goal is to reduce inflammatory factors from your diet. And that's also a similar goal with Hashimoto's. So with both are both have such an element of inflammation as being an impact. So they really kind of go hand in hand when it comes to those diet changes. So because of the Hashimoto's, I specifically had to remove gluten from my diet, which at the time I don't think I realized was it was causing my kind of composition of my plates to be really different than they are now. So mm-hmm. just naturally I gravitated more towards carbohydrates in the sense that I was eating more like sandwiches, more bread, more pasta. It's just what I naturally liked more. So removing gluten and it kind of forced me to change my plate up a bit. I was almost forced to add more protein because I wasn't getting the same like calories from the carbs. I wasn't getting the same energy that I was getting before. And I just kind of had to switch things around. That this is, of course, not to say that carbs are bad. I still absolutely eat carbs. They're different. They have to be different because I can't eat gluten.
Yeah.
So I'm eating more like whole grains, unprocessed carbohydrates, which is one of the main recommendations for PCOS mm-hmm. is to limit processed foods mm-hmm. because of the impact that it can have on inflammation in the body. So both removing that potentially inflammatory food for both of these conditions, as well as increasing both the protein as well as the fruits and vegetables I was eating. Because again, I was just needing more. I'm like, I'm hungry. I need more of these different things that I can eat. It forced me to get in more fiber, more protein, and create a little bit more variety too in my food that I think was really helpful for both of these conditions.
I think it's really interesting. Like you made this change because of this diagnosis, because of fertility reasons, you know? But it's like it had the symptom of body composition change, like the unintentional symptom of body composition change.
I was in no way specifically trying for that,
which
was very interesting to see it all kind of play out.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned PCOS being linked to insulin resistance. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah. So that piece really comes from the increase in testosterone. Now, I'm not specifically sure of the mechanism of why that leads to being more insulin resistant for this population, but that's what it's linked to, is this increase in testosterone. And so then it begins to function very similarly to these other metabolic conditions like obesity, like diabetes, different things like that. And what's interesting with the obesity component as well, and something that I came across in research, is that our fat cells also produce estrogen, which did you know that? I didn't know that
before this
research. So our fat cells also produce estrogen. So when that's happening, that even further dampens the production of estrogen by the ovaries, because the brain doesn't know, even though there are different types of estrogen that are being produced, the brain doesn't know that it's not coming from the ovaries and that it's not the same type of estrogen. So it further dampens the estrogen production from the ovaries, which then further upregulates the testosterone pathway.
So it spirals everything.
Yeah. Wow. So that's why so often one of the like main tips that you see online for PCOS treatment is weight loss. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the main reasons why, is because of the fat cell production of estrogen. So I just thought that was really fascinating to try and kind of peel back and take away, because I think obesity can be like a really almost triggering topic mm-hmm. and a really sensitive topic. Mm-hmm. And so just looking into, I really wanted to understand the why. Like mm-hmm. it can't just be like, because weight loss is good for you, quote unquote. And so it was interesting to see the physiological mechanism behind why they were recommending a reduction in weight, specifically fat loss.
Yes, that's really interesting. So What are the long-term risks of PCOS and is it curable?
So with PCOS, the scariest, for lack of a scientific word, the scariest risk long-term is endometrial cancer. And I kind of alluded to this in that previous episode, but the reason that this is more of a risk in this population is because when you don't have progesterone present, from that happens after you ovulate and the corpus luteum creates the progesterone. When you don't have that present, you're not ever having a full cycle where you're fully turning over and shedding the entire lining of the uterus. So when you don't have that full cell turnover and you're having some of the lining just lingers and then builds up and up, that puts you at a much higher risk for endometrial cancer. So that's a very scary and a very real thing. So that's why it's important that people with PCOS work either through lifestyle changes or if needing medication to allow them to have a full cycle so that they can shed the lining. Because it's very likely for me, especially with the spotting, they describe it as like when you don't have a good progesterone present, it's like a dripping faucet instead of like fully letting go. So that could have been the spotting. It's just like the little dripping basically out. So it's very likely that I wasn't ever, even though I was having a period, it's very possible that I wasn't fully shedding my lining for multiple years.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's the scariest long-term risk besides all the ones that we've talked about with the metabolic dysfunction and metabolic syndromes.
Yes. Is it curable?
So through these, like lifestyle is the number one thing to do for sure. But depending on the person and depending on how high what's called their AMH level is, this is a hormone that you can measure in the blood and is a very good way to kind of determine if someone might have PCOS. That's how it was confirmed for me in addition to these symptoms. And normal for under 35 is between 2 to 4, and anything above 4.5 is likely PCOS, minus 7.7. So she's up there. And what I have found is that the higher your AMH level, the less likely that you will be able to ovulate on your own. So even with doing all the quote unquote right things that we'll get a little bit more into, even through changing these lifestyle factors, it's still very likely that you'll need medical assistance for ovulation. So whether that's in the form of a medication that assists with ovulation, even if you're not trying to get pregnant, just so you can have that turnover, or employing something like birth control, which again can be a really hot topic and not necessarily something that we need to dive into, but that is something that OBs employ to help with that cycle regulation. And it's also interesting because the pill specifically has factors in it that bind to that testosterone. So they're both helping with the regularity of the cycle as well as binding to that testosterone.
So it would help with symptoms potentially as well.
So it can help with symptoms. But oftentimes when people have been on birth control for forever and they come off of it, they then start showing these symptoms and so that's what has kind of created the spark of like birth control created my PCOS or caused my PCOS.
Oh.
But really what was probably happening is that it was masking what was going on.
Interesting.
So that's just kind of a side conversation, but that's why I think it's so important to marry the two, to have the lifestyle factors involved. And then if you're still needing assistance, like that's where I am, then going and utilizing medication as well, as I don't think it's a bad thing. But of course, this is always between you and your medical provider, just providing insight into what we're finding with the research.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about the lifestyle stuff.
Yeah.
What are the recommendations for exercise?
Yeah. So with PCOS in general, just for like general health, most of the research is on aerobic exercise and comparing.
They don't study women in strength training very much, do they?
No, they don't. So most of the research is comparing vigorous to moderate exercise, and kind of different than what we described in the fertility episode. With this population, with the systematic review comparing comparing vigorous and moderate aerobic exercise as well as resistance training. We'll get into a little bit of that. Vigorous wins out over moderate by a landslide. Like moderate doesn't show any benefits, and vigorous shows significant benefits for reducing these metabolic symptoms. Thinking of HIIT, like calling it a term that people are more familiar with. That's why if you see online, like HIIT training is so recommended online for PCOS because of this research and showing like its effect. But the main mechanism that they describe as to why they recommend it is weight loss, which we know that we don't have to do HIIT in order to achieve weight loss or fat loss.
In fact, it's not really that effective if you're not changing your diet.
Right. So that's one interesting element of it. And then in this same study, they also looked at free androgen index, which is an accurate way or one of the ways we have to measure that testosterone that might be present. And interestingly, resistance training was the only thing that had a moderate effect on it. Vigorous and moderate aerobic activity pretty much didn't have an effect on that element of it. So that was something interesting to note, but they also noted the studies were limited for resistance training, so more studies need to be done.
Yes.
And then for the insulin resistance element of it, both vigorous exercise as well as resistance training both showed a moderate effect on insulin resistance and improving insulin resistance. But then when they took it further and did, you know, the predicted analysis, because of the lack of studies included, because of the lack of data with resistance training, they were only able to say with confidence that vigorous aerobic activity sealed the deal.
Simply because they've studied it longer.
Yeah.
Not because it's necessarily better.
Exactly.
But what I think is interesting is we talked earlier about how one of the symptoms of PCOS is decreased stress tolerance, and HIIT is a stressor on your body. Mm-hmm. So if somebody hears do HIIT and they're like, okay, well, I better do HIIT every single day.
Right.
Couldn't that, if in their stress tolerance is lower, would that make the whole issue worse? Or what are your thoughts there?
Yes, 100% I think so. I think it's such a fine line, and there just needs to be so much more research behind dosage. Mm-hmm. So with just like with diet with this population, although they recommend fat loss and weight loss if you are needing to, mm-hmm. they also don't recommend an intense diet because of the stress that could cause to the body and have the reverse effects.
Don't want like a severe calorie deficit.
Exactly. Exactly. They recommend a very slight calorie deficit going over a long period of time.
Interesting.
So similarly, I would think that you would want a very small amount of HIIT or the level of HIIT that your body is able to tolerate and monitoring the different factors of recovery, like we've talked about a ton. I think it's going to be one, super individualized, and two, probably pretty low for this population if we are so sensitive to stress.
Yeah. Well, I think one tool that might be helpful for people is learning to monitor their recovery, which I think no one is really taught. I mean, we talk about it on the podcast all the time, but do you want to like briefly go over, in case someone's not familiar with the podcast, what would be some indications that you're not recovering and you're doing too much and potentially the dosage is backfiring?
Yeah. Sleep is one great thing to look into. If your sleep has changed, if this change in your exercise routine and increasing HIIT, because you see that this is what you're supposed to do, if that leads to a decrease in the quality of your sleep or the quantity of your sleep, that's a great thing to look at if there's any sleep disturbances there. Also looking into how you are feeling from a physical perspective. Are you having increased soreness? Some soreness isn't necessarily bad, but are you feeling achy and sore all the time? Are your joints hurting? Again, could be a sign of that increased inflammation in the body in general. And then something that two different tools that we've talked about in previous episodes is utilizing grip strength to see how your body is responding. So either using an official tool like a handheld dynamometer that actually gives you that force output, or just using it a more subjective way of like squeezing a towel or squeezing a ball at the beginning of the week of your workouts versus the end. If you're having like a crazy drop or crazy decrease in that grip strength, might be a sign that you're not recovering well enough throughout your week in general. And then another tool is looking at what's the name of the test? The breath test.
CO2 tolerance.
CO2 tolerance test. And we can put a link. We'll put a link for kind of we have a blog post about how to measure all of these things. Yeah. So we can link that there that describes the CO2 tolerance test. But that's something that you could easily do at home in order to check and see if you're recovering.
Yes. So given all of this, what would be a good dosage for someone to start with? Like what would be a good exercise routine for someone to start with?
Yeah. So when thinking about it, I also went and looked to see if there were any systematic reviews that just looked at resistance training and PCOS. And there was one from 2021 and 2022, and both said like resistance training is great, but the studies are limited and more needs to be done. So like not much can be taken from this.
Yeah,
but they also said that this needs to be looked at, especially for people who can't tolerate the 120 minutes of vigorous activity that's, you know, quote unquote recommended. And so for me, when I look at that and we see that resistance training in the smaller grouping of studies shows to be beneficial, I think starting there, having that be your base, like we pretty much always recommend, but is super relevant for this population. Starting there, and then if you're wanting to add on HIIT and you're feeling good and you're not in a place where you're having a ton of increase in stress with your job, if you're able to get your 7 to 8 hours of sleep, if you're eating well, then adding in one, maybe two less than 15-minute HIIT sessions would be where I would recommend starting.
Yeah, absolutely. Because like you said, if PCOS is so closely linked to insulin resistance, we want to improve insulin sensitivity.
Exactly.
Which we know building muscle and strength training does that.
Right. And there's tons and tons and tons of studies behind populations like diabetic populations that shows the power of strength training on insulin resistance. And not that they are one-to-one or exactly equal, but super similar in some of the ways that it functions on a metabolic level. So it makes a lot of sense that increasing your muscle mass to increase those glycogen storage units would be beneficial for this population, especially because it is so much less stressful from a systemic point of view if you're taking these like really this really targeted strength training as your crux, as your base.
Yes, this makes total sense. Let's pivot a little bit and talk about, because those were just recommendations if you have PCOS, not necessarily recommendations for fertility specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people get into this or start asking questions about this in their own bodies when they're trying to conceive. So what would be some recommendations for exercise for fertility if you do have PCOS? Would those recommendations that you just spoke about change, or would it be pretty much the same?
Very similar. So there's not much data behind it or not many studies behind it, but there was a mini review that looks into both normal, quote unquote, normal, healthy females, females with PCOS, and females undergoing IVF treatments. So looking at the portion of that study that specifically focuses on PCOS, it again shows that moderate aerobic exercise has no benefits for fertility specifically, but it does show that both vigorous exercise and strength training and resistance training do have positive effects on fertility. And it also shows, which we know and love, but loved seeing in research, that the amount of time someone's doing it in terms of like months to years makes a big difference. So being consistent is one of the biggest factors in resistance training or vigorous aerobic activity having a positive effect on fertility. Mm-hmm. So not to scare you and be like, not to say you're doomed if you haven't started already, but just meaning that finding a routine that feels really good for you and one that you're able to stick with clearly is very important.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So with that in taking that into consideration, my recommendations really wouldn't change. But if anything, it would be maybe you don't need to do the hit. If your other stuff has to be so dialed in, if your other stuff, as in your diet, your sleep, your stress management, has to be so dialed in my opinion, especially if trying to conceive in this population, that if those truly are dialed in, then maybe adding in a HIIT session. But if resistance training can have similar effects, why not start there?
Yeah. And if it's less stressful on your body. And I think a lot of people are like, well, what can I do? What can I add? And they want to add all these things when really they're only sleeping 5 hours a night mm-hmm. and it's crappy sleep. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no matter how much exercise you do or how dialed that is, if you're not sleeping very well, it might not have the same, you still might struggle. That still might be the number one thing
right.
to look at or diet. And that kind of brings me to my next question, which yep. what are some other non-exercise ways to manage PCOS?
Yep. So diet's a huge one. Yep. And I think probably one that is not relied on enough. I think exercise and vigorous exercise specifically is too pushed for this population
yeah.
that it throws out the baby with the bathwater because you end up overstressing yourself, which is counter to what you're trying to do in general.
I feel like that's with everything. Like it's so not, much. Yes. It's like just this industry in general, they overstress the exercise piece and yes. understress the other lifestyle things.
Yes. If someone is overweight and has PCOS, then instead of focusing on more and more vigorous activity, focusing on a really, really sustainable diet that's a very, very small caloric deficit, again, to not overstress from being in too much of a caloric deficit, and then focus on prioritizing those whole grains as unprocessed as you can, adding in lots and lots of fruits and vegetables, having that be like a high portion. Even focusing, research shows, on the quality of the meat you're consuming, if you are a meat eater, can be important. And really, I would highly recommend working with a registered dietitian. And there are a lot of registered dietitians that specifically focus on this population
yeah.
and specifically focus on fertility. And so I think this is a great opportunity to work one-on-one with someone and spend your time really honing that in, because that can be such a good base for everything.
It's worth the investment because it can change your life.
Yeah, it really can. And it's been such a big thing for me. And not that I am pregnant now, you know, I'm not saying that like this diet solved every problem, but shifting my diet has had a major effect on my energy levels and I worked with Hope, the registered dietitian that does a ton for Evlo, but has had a major effect on energy levels and I've seen changes in my symptoms in general as well. So it's very, very worth the investment to maybe even start there and add in just a little bit of strength training,
yeah.
but really focus in on honing in your diet. If you're in a population that you might need to decrease fat to mitigate these effects on your estrogen dampening.
Yes. Yes. Well, this was so informative. I'm really happy that you are again willing to come on here and share your story, your experience. Are there any last words that you have on this topic? Anything that we left out that you feel like is important to include?
I think just a couple things of when thinking about other things to do, stress management is a huge one. Mm-hmm. So finding something that works for you from a stress management perspective, whether that's daily guided meditation, whether that's walking meditations or yoga or acupuncture, those are all really, really recommended for this population. And it's not that one is better than the other, but it's important to find what helps you decrease your stress so that everything else can be better.
Yeah.
And focusing on your sleep as well. This is probably my biggest struggle and something that I'm really committed to trying to improve is both the quality and quantity of my sleep, because I think that can have a big effect as well. And then the only other thing I really want to leave people with, and I kind of alluded to this earlier, but sometimes you can do all the right things and it's okay if it doesn't lead to the ultimate outcome if you're trying to conceive of having a baby. Like that's not been the story for me. And so I don't want people to ever hear all of this information and think like, I'm just not doing enough, yeah. or I'm sorry, I'm not, I don't know why I'm getting emotional, but like, it's important to know that like sometimes you can do all these things and all of these things are worth doing just for the sake of what it can do for your overall health.
Yeah.
But that it is okay to go and continue to seek out advice from your individual medical provider and go down the path that you and your partner want to go down to, like, if the ultimate goal is to conceive, to know that like it's not you, you're doing great things, and it's okay to still not have that ultimate outcome yet.
Thank you for saying that, because I think a lot of women blame themselves or think like, I need to be doing more and more and more, when in reality, sometimes there might be other interventions that you do need to do. So I'm really glad that you said that. I think a lot of times too, like, we'll hear the success stories. We'll hear like, I just changed all these things and now all of a sudden I'm cured. And it's like, it's not always that simple. So I think it's good to hear from you who you're still in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm. Very, very much so. So I want people to know, like, I think it's amazing when it does. And I think it can, the lifestyle stuff can be everything that someone needs, and it does do the trick, but not always, and that's okay too.
Yes. Well, Peyton, thank you so much for being here, for sharing your story, for researching this so deeply. And listeners, we will see you all next week, same time, same place. Bye for now.